Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Proverbs chapter 6. I'll call this chapter Warnings Against Folly. Of course, this chapter of Proverbs is written by King Solomon. Solomon starts in chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Now in verse 1, Solomon tells his son to not become a surety for his neighbor or for a stranger. Now, a surety, of course, is when you guarantee the debt of another. If the debtor doesn't pay the creditor, then you will pay the debt in place of the debtor. Is this exhortation here an absolute command not to enter into sureties? It sounds like it. But John Gill says, no, the prohibition is only against rash sureties, stupid sureties. John Gill says this, it is a rash and inconsiderate entering into suretyship that is here cautioned against, doing it without inquiring into and having sufficient knowledge of the person engaged for, and without considering whether able to answer the obligation if required, without hurting a man's self and family. Otherwise, suretyship may lawfully be entered into and good be done by it, and no hurt to the surety himself and family. I think Gill is right here because a surety is a creditor, and there's nothing wrong with lending money, even in the Old Testament, as long as it was for a business loan and not a charity loan. So here are my thoughts on how one could make a case for a sensible surety agreement. The surety rationally weighs out the risk. The surety knows that he can stand the hit if the debtor can't pay the creditor, and the surety has to pay it. He'd write it off as a bad business loss, but he can stand that. In other words, the debt is not so large that it will sink the surety if the debtor doesn't pay. Also, if you have good reason for being a surety, for example, a family member, typically minors can't buy cars, the father will sign the loan as a surety because the minor son is a minor and thus not liable on his contracts, and so the father will be a surety. Well, that's a family member. He can go after his son. If the son defaults, he says, okay, son, I'm going to pay for the car now, and you're going to have to work it off. Or another reason you might be a surety, if you get paid for it. When a bank issues a letter of credit, for example, is basically a surety. If the businessman doesn't perform his obligations, the bank will honor a letter of credit and pay off. So the bank is basically a surety there. And they're in it for the money. So you pay somebody for a surety. That's perfectly decent, perfectly understandable. Another factor in whether you should be a surety or not is if you are willing to let the debt go as a gift in case the debtor defaults on his loan. And you say, okay, well, I'll pay it. I'll just consider it a gift. You don't have to pay me back for having to cover your debt. But if you don't do any of those things, you are the biggest sucker in the world to be a surety. And Solomon says that here. He also says it in other Proverbs. Proverbs 17:18, a man lacking in sense pledges and becomes guarantor in the presence of his neighbor. A guarantor is a surety. Proverbs 22:26-27, do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed from you? And in this case, in Proverbs 22:27, we see a surety who undertakes a surety agreement that is so large that if he can't pay it, he's going to lose his bed. And that's not the type of surety you want to get into. That proverb doesn't cover situations in which the surety does have the money to pay. Now in verse 1, Solomon says, if, son, you've given a pledge for a stranger, that's different than a neighbor, because a neighbor is not a stranger. A stranger is an alien. There's two ways to look at this. One is Solomon is telling his son not to give surety for a stranger, or it could be that Solomon is saying, don't give your surety to your neighbor who owes the stranger the debt. I don't think so. I think it's don't give your surety for a stranger. Now, of course, a stranger would be someone whose creditworthiness would be hard to check. And so you might ask, well, why would one even go surety for a stranger? Well, if he's foolish and making a rash surety contract, well, then maybe that's why. On the other hand, it could be that Solomon is saying, don't guarantee your neighbor's debts against a stranger. Depends on how you want to look at it. So Solomon says, if you've been snared by the words of your mouth, caught by the words of your mouth, deliver yourself. You're like a hunted bird, a hunted beast of prey when you enter into such a foolish contract. You've come into the hand of your neighbor. Go humble yourself. Importune your neighbor. In verse 3, importune, of course, is old-fashioned language for make a serious request of your neighbor. Let me out. There's no legal way out of the surety contract, but perhaps the neighbor will release the surety voluntarily. Then in verse 4, Solomon says, give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand. A gazelle, of course, is a deer-like animal that runs very, very fast. Get out of debt. When you're a surety, you are in debt. You have taken on the debtor's debt, and so that means you are a debtor too, just like the debtor, and debt can kill you, like adulterous women, gambling, cocaine. A gazelle runs fast, and a bird flies fast, and Solomon says in verse 4, be like a gazelle and be like a bird. Get away from that surety contract. We go now to Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 11. Solomon says, go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise, which, having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond and your need like an armed man. Now this, of course, is a favorite proverb that's quoted a lot. I remember at seminary, I would hear students exhorting each other, ah, you're lying down, huh? When you're going to get up, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and you've got an F. This is a great proverb to use on super spiritual Christians who think that God will just put the food in their mouth and they don't have to work hard. Well, even a pitifully weak and insignificant creature like an ant works hard, and God made the ant. The ant survives by working hard, taking foresight. John Gill says the ant will travel over flints and stones, climb trees, enter into towers, barns, cellars, places high and low in search of food. The ant will never hinder but help one another. The ants will never hinder but help one another in carrying their burdens, prepare little cells to put their provisions in, and are so built as to secure them from rain. And if at any time their corn is wet, they bring out and dry it and bite off the ends of it that it may not grow. That's a great description of ants. Gill apparently is an ant expert. Another proverb, not written by Solomon, but by Agur, A-G-U-R. That's how I pronounce his name. It might be Agur. I don't know. But this proverb in Proverbs 30, 24 through 27 mentions ants. Four things are small on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. Same thing that's said here in Proverbs 6. The Shephanim, and that's the hydraxes of the coney, some animal that I'm not familiar with. The Shephanim are not mighty people, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. And the point is that these weak, pitiful little ants do incredible things to stay alive. So maybe you ought to do the same thing, and you ought to work hard. Nobody's happy, not really, if they're not working as hard as they can. I don't mean burnout. That's another extreme. But being lazy, there's no excuse for that. The ant in verse 7 is said by Solomon to have no chief. Contrast humans. As John Gill says, humans have parents, masters, ministers, magistrates to guide, direct, exhort, and instruct them. But an ant doesn't have any of those things. No officers, no rulers, but yet she prepares her food in the summer. She does that in order to get through the winter, because you can't grow food in the winter. That is a good verse for saving in our money economy, our capitalist economy. We're not agricultural so much anymore, but things do go bad, and you need to have some money to tide you over. All financial advisors will say, prepare a cash savings pot of about 6 months of work, so in case you lose your job, you've got something to tide you over until you find your next job. That's good advice. Comes right out of here, Proverbs 6. The ant prepares her food in the summer, gathers her provision in the harvest. I'm assuming the harvest is in the summer. We have an expression, make hay while the sun shines. It's the same idea, because the sun is not always going to shine. How long will you lie down, sluggard? Verse 11, your poverty will come in like a vagabond. Now, there are several causes of poverty. Solomon is mentioning laziness here, but there's also other causes of poverty, such as ill fortune, maybe a low birth. You're born into poverty. Maybe you get sick. You have ill health. And some people just like to live in poverty. They don't like to work. Don't bother them. Well, to each his own, but I think poverty is a terrible curse. It is. I've known people in poverty. I've lived in other parts of the world and seen. I've been to Africa, been friends with Indian people, lived in China. I'm telling you, poverty is a horrible curse. Poverty is mentioned in Deuteronomy 28 as a curse. Well, God will give you the ability to make wealth, even as he gave the Israelites the ability to make wealth, but he expected the Israelites to work hard, and Solomon says that here. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond if you sleep all the time. Vagabond is translated as robber in the Holman Christian Study Bible, and robbers come in quick. Bang! They come in and they break your windows down, your doors down, they steal your goods, and that's how fast poverty will rob you if you don't work hard. Clark says that this vagabond or robber will come with slow but surely approaching steps. I don't think so. I think of Kanye West, who's gotten into Black Hebrew Israel religion, which is a cult, a racist cult, and he was worth about $1.5 billion when he gets up on Twitter and says, I wish DEFCON 3 would come on my Jewish brethren, or whatever he said, something like that. He refused to apologize for it. And he's now down to $400 million at last count. He said that God was stripping him of his wealth to teach him. Well, that poverty is coming on him real quick, not because of his laziness, but because of his big mouth and his getting involved into a cult. Here's some other scriptures that talk about hard work. Proverbs 10:4, and these are all proverbs written by Solomon. Proverbs 10:4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Proverbs 12:24, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. Proverbs 19:15, laziness cast into a deep sleep, and an idle man will suffer hunger. Proverbs 24:30-34, I passed by the field of the sluggard, and by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Then your poverty will come as a robber and your want like an armed man. Now, of course, verse 33 and verse 34 are exact replicas of our Proverbs here in Proverbs 6, verses 10 and 11. Proverbs 19:24 says this, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish, but will not even bring it back to his mouth. He's so lazy, he's got the food by the hand, can't even get it into his mouth. We move now to Proverbs 6:12-19. We go into another sin that Solomon is exhorting against. Let's review here quickly. Verses 1 through 5, he says, no stupid sureties. Verses 6 through 11, no laziness. And now in verses 12 through 19, no deviousness, trickery, pride, that kind of thing. Verse 12, a worthless person, a wicked man, is the one who walks with a perverse mouth, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his fingers, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil, who spreads strife. Therefore his calamity will come suddenly. Instantly he will be broken and there will be no healing. There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue. Haughty eyes is number one, lying tongues, number two, hands that shed innocent blood, number three, a heart that devises wicked plans, number four, feet that run rapidly to evil, number five, number six, a false witness who utters lies, number seven, and one who spreads strife among brothers. In verse 12, Solomon refers to a worthless person who does all these things. The Hebrew there is a man of Belial. Belial means devil. A man of the devil is the one who does all these horrible things. First of all, he walks with a perverse mouth. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as speaking dishonestly. Perverse mouth is NASB. So he walks around speaking lies. Verse 13, he winks with his eyes. Now, some have speculated that maybe that means to sneer at the weakness of another by winking your eye. Like, let's say you're talking to some poor, pathetic wretch, and you look at your friend and you wink your eye and says, I'm going to help you, brother. But I think more likely it means that the winker is arranging a secret plan to conspire against his opponents. For example, he's negotiating with his opponents and says, I'll do this deal with you. Then he looks at his associate and he winks his eye at him where the opposite party can't see. We do that too, so I think that's what it is. This person, this devious person who speaks with a perverse mouth, signals with his feet, who points with his fingers. Signaling with his feet would probably be the same thing, like I'm making a deal with somebody, and all of a sudden my business associate listens to what I say, and he looks at me and says, and you can see the look in his eyes, I don't think that's a good idea. But then I kick him with his foot and says, don't worry about it, I got it. I'm going to screw this guy eventually. You just don't see how I'm going to do it yet. So he signals with his feet. Adam Clark says that this actually could refer to debauchees who are signaling their intentions for adultery under the table by the feet. Ovid has men who do that. Ovid is a perfectly filthy pagan writer. He ended up in exile, and for good reason. I've actually read Ovid's Metamorphoses because he's so famous. He's classical. And I read it, and I said, man, this is the dirtiest-minded guy I've ever read in my life. But at any rate, you can imagine people sitting at a table, and all of a sudden, the man starts stroking the woman's ankles with his feet, and the intention is obvious. I want you, baby. Reminds me, I had a good friend of mine who's gone on to be with the Lord now, but when he was in high school, he went on a double date. He was sitting at Mitchell's Drugstore, old drugstore in my hometown, and the two girls were on one side, and the two boys were on the other side of the table, and all of a sudden, my friend felt this feminine foot running up and down his ankles. And he's thinking, boy, this is a good date here. Turns out, it was the date of his friend that was running her foot up his ankles. She got confused as to whose foot she was going after. Now, this devious person not only signals with his feet and winks with his eyes, he points with his fingers, using secret language that only conspirators know. I'm not exactly sure how that might be done. But at any rate, they're not honest. They're not straightforward. And in verse 14, they with perversity in their heart continually devise evil. They spread strife. And what happens to that person? Verse 15, his calamity will come suddenly. Instantly he will be broken and there will be no healing. He gets what he deserves. Now, in verse 16, Solomon summarizes dishonesty here. Six things the Lord hates and seven which are an abomination. Now, that's a common Hebrew formulation there. It's not meant to be an exclusive list of the things that the Lord hates. It just emphasizes the progressive evil. Six things, but now we're going to go to seven things that the Lord hates. And, of course, seven is the number of perfection, completion, and maturity, well-known symbol in Old Testament writings, also in the book of Revelation 2, in the New Testament. How many times would you forgive your neighbor? Seven times seven times 77, however many times it is, I forgot. So this is the idea here. This is perfect evil in the eyes of God. Now, some people say the seventh thing is actually the worst thing of all the seven things that are mentioned. Now, in our list here, the seventh thing is the one who spreads strife among brothers. Well, included in the first six things are hands that shed innocent blood. So I don't see how spreading strife among brothers, as bad as that is as bad as killing somebody. So I don't go for that. It's just a Hebrew way of saying God is really upset with this kind of stuff. The first thing he says he's upset with in verse 17 is haughty eyes, which is a great way of saying a proud man. They lift their head up. They stick their chin up in the air, and they look down on you. Lying tongue, liars, hands that shed blood, murderers, heart that devise wicked plans, conspirators, feet that run rapidly to evil, people who do evil. Verse 19, a false witness who utters lies, that of course refers to witnesses in court. Perjurers, of course, sin number two was a lying tongue, and sin number six is a false witness. Those are similar. Lying tongue might be just lies in general. False witness might be perjury in a legal situation in a court. At any rate, the intention is clear. Stay away from these guys, son, Solomon says. So we go now to Proverbs 6, verses 20 through 22. Solomon continues, my son, observe the commandment of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk to you. The son there, I've mentioned this over and over again in the first five chapters. He could be one of Solomon's sons. I'm not going to speculate anymore on who that might be. It doesn't really matter. That would be Solomon's blood sons. Some people speculated it could be someone who looked at Solomon as some kind of spiritual father. I don't know. A guy that was an idolater as a spiritual father? I don't think so. He might be wise, but he wasn't an idolater. So I think it's his blood son. My son, observe the commandment of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. This sounds just like what Solomon said in Proverbs 1 verse 8. Hear, my son, your father's instruction and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Now the mention of mother there shows that the mother deserves every bit as much respect as the father. It is a fact of family life that children often slight their mother while they stand in awe of their father because their father's meaner, tougher. And so they say, Mama, Mama, can I do this? And they don't go to their father. No, you're supposed to listen to your mother. And that also should be an instruction to mothers. You need to teach the same thing the fathers are doing. You need to tell your sons that haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, and a heart that devises wicked plans, and feet that run rapidly to evil, and a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among his brothers, is a bad person. So, son, don't do it. So the mother needs to be involved. Now, these commandments, Solomon says in verse 21, son, bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. Now, binding the law around a physical part of the body is an allusion to the law. Of course, it's not meant to be taken literally. That would be absurd. The famous passage in the law, Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 8, these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. See, binding them on your heart, they shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. Now, of course, the Jews over-literalized this. And they said, okay, we need to make little leather boxes, put them on our wrist, on our hands, and put them on our forehead, and we'll write some scripture down and put them in the little box, which is absurd. That's not what the verse meant. It just means keep them on your heart so you think about them all the time with your understanding. You understand the words, the law, the words of God will deal with your affections, your emotions, with your will. It'll make you want to do the right things. It'll affect your memory. Heart stands for the internal workings of the human being, which is understanding, affections, will, memory, or mind, will, and emotions, if you will. The law will affect all that. So bind it on your heart, metaphorically speaking. Bind them continually on your heart. Don't let them ever go away. Tie them around your neck. That would be for ornaments, or either that or for easy access, so you can get it. You can get the Word of God whenever you want, or get the commandments of your Father. When you walk about, the commandments of your father will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. So day or night, the commandments of your father are with you. And then when you wake up in the morning, the commandments of your father will talk to you. The commandments of your father and your mother. When you sleep, in your dreams, you will dream about what your mind is occupied with all day long. And if you're occupied all day long with the commands of your father, you'll dream about them at night. Now the question arises is, what happens if your father gives you some bum advice? That does happen. I mean, we don't live in a perfect world. We don't have perfect fathers. This is assuming, of course, wise advice from the father. Basic advice like, don't run around with loose women. Don't rob banks. Don't blow up people's mailboxes with cherry bombs. Don't put smoke bombs into burger restaurants. The obvious things that young people are too stupid not to do. I'm referring to some unfortunate events in my past. I did not bind the commandments of my father around my neck. He was an atheist, but he had more sense than that. So this is assuming common sense commands from a father and mother to their sons to listen to your parents. We go down to Proverbs 6, verses 23 through 29. Solomon continues, for the commandment is a lamp and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for the precious life. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Now in verse 23, Solomon says, the commandment is a lamp. And the commandment he's referring to, of course, is the commandment of the father to his son. It is a lamp. A lamp lights up your path so you can see where to go, so the son can see where to go. Psalms 119:105 says, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. Not only God's word is such a lamp, but also the father's word is such a lamp. At the end of verse 23, Solomon says, the teaching is light. That does not mean as opposed to heavy. It means the teaching is light in the sense that it gives light to the path like a lamp does. Solomon continues, verse 23, reproofs for discipline are the way of life. In other words, a path that leads to life is one that is embarked upon only by the one who receives reproofs in order to discipline him. And some of the discipline that you need in verse 24, son, is to keep you from the evil woman. Of course, that's talking about harlots and adulteresses. Adulteresses are specifically mentioned at the end of verse 24, to keep you from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Now, Adam Clark says that Solomon had suffered greatly from such women, and that's why he constantly warns his sons against sexually promiscuous women. Now, does this mean that Solomon has committed adultery? Does Clark think that? Well, I don't see how. Solomon had 1,000 wives to have sex with. Who in the world would be available in Solomon's life to commit adultery with? Every woman in sight he was married to. Why would he even want to commit adultery with all those women? So I don't think that we can say that Solomon was an adulterer or someone who went into adulteresses. But we can say that he sure was mad at them, mad at adulteresses. I'm just going to give you some proverbs that he wrote giving admonitions against sexual immorality. And I'm not sure I found them all. This might not even be an exhaustive list. Proverbs 2, 16 through 19. It will rescue from a forbidden woman. I think it's wisdom. From a stranger with her flattering talk, who abandons the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God, for her house sinks down to death and her ways to the land of the departed spirits. None return who go to her, none reach the paths of life. In other words, the adulteress is going to kill you, son. Proverbs 5, 3 through 11. Though the lips of the forbidden woman drip honey and her words are smoother than oil, in the end she's as bitter as wormwood and as sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps head straight for Sheol, Sheol's the grave. She doesn't consider the path of life, she doesn't know that her ways are unstable. So now, my sons, listen to me and don't turn away from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her. Don't go near the door of her house, otherwise you will give up your vitality to others and your years to someone cruel. Strangers will drain your resources and your earnings will end up in a foreigner's house. At the end of your life, you will lament when your physical body has been consumed. So you're going to be paying money probably for bastard children. You're going to be eaten up with physical disease when your body has been consumed, when you catch an STD. And plus, the adulteress herself will be as bitter as wormwood. She'll turn on you. Proverbs 22, verse 14. The mouth of the forbidden woman is a deep pit. A man cursed by the Lord will fall into it. Don't listen to the words of an adulteress. And even here at our chapter 6, we haven't gotten there yet, but we will in just a minute. Verses 32 through 35. The one who commits adultery lacks sense. Whoever does so destroys himself. He will get a beating and dishonor, and his disgrace will never be removed. For jealousy enrages a husband, and he will show no mercy when he takes revenge. He will not be appeased by anything or be persuaded by lavish gifts. Cuckolded husbands tend to be unreasonable, angry. Well, going back to Proverbs 6, verse 24, Solomon says, son, your father's commandment will keep you from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. The smooth tongue. A woman's words can be as seductive as her body. Verse 25, Solomon tells his son, do not desire her beauty in her heart. Now, of course, that's not talking about spiritual beauty. It's talking about physical beauty. And, of course, the external beauty of a woman is what always initially attracts men. You can't get around that. That's nature. That's the way men are made. But lust conceived can become lust matured. And lust matured is the moral equivalent of adultery. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:28, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I do believe that what Jesus was talking about is somebody looks at a woman and desires to have her for his concubine, his wife, his girlfriend, whatever, his lover. I don't think it means that he looks at a woman and thinks, well, she's hot, she looks good. For one reason, women back then wore clothes, loose-fitting clothes from neck to ankles. How are you going to lust after somebody like that temporarily? I think what it means is, I'm going to go get that woman because I'm in love with her. In other words, I think Jesus was talking about people who think they're in love with somebody else's wife, not that they think she's physically hot. But at any rate, whether it's lust or love, you need to keep yourself away from somebody else's wife. And the initial beauty of a woman is extremely intoxicating for the male gender. Solomon says at the end of verse 25, do not let the adulteress capture you with her eyelids. That's just a particular example of beauty a woman's eyelids, they can be very beautiful, especially when they start fluttering like a bird's wings. Oh, she's making eyes at me, we say. Yeah, right. Don't be captured by that. Verse 26, for on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. Now notice that Solomon is talking about harlots here, which is not quite the same thing as an adulteress. He doesn't seem to make too much of a distinction between the two because both of them are equally deadly. They will reduce you to a loaf of bread after you have to pay the doctor's bills for the STDs. Of course, they didn't have that back then, but you do have to pay the maintenance fees for all the bastard children you might conceive, whatever. Or just because you're so taken up with your lust, you don't attend to business. You quit working. Now, there's a translation issue here in verse 26. The NASB says, for on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. There's another way that that can be translated. The Septuagint translates it as, the price of a whore is about one loaf. Proverbs 6:26 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says this, for a prostitute's fee is only a loaf of bread. Proverbs 6:26 in the New American Bible, for the price of a loose woman may be scarcely a loaf of bread, but if she is married, she is a trap for your precious life. In other words, you can spend a little bit of money on a prostitute, but by golly, you'll pay a lot bigger price than that when you commit adultery. God's Word translation of this verse says, a prostitute's price is only a loaf of bread, but a married woman hunts for your life itself. What a deal, if this is the correct translation. Let me back up here a minute. There's two options that one can use to translate the verse. You can say that the man who goes into the adulterers is reduced to a loaf of bread, or you can say the adulteress takes her fee, which is a loaf of bread. So the translation is ambiguous. It can go either way. But let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that the translation is correct that says the prostitute's fee is a loaf of bread. What a deal! The man who goes into the harlot pays a loaf of bread and he gets death and poverty in return. The upside is next to worthless, but the downside is fatal. Well, let's take the alternate translation that the one who goes into the harlot is reduced to a loaf of bread. How can that happen? How does a life of sexual dissipation lead to poverty? Well, here's some examples. Money spent on chasing, paying, and entertaining prostitutes and adulteresses. The loss of productive time while one chases, pays for, and entertains prostitutes and adulteresses, paying hush money when the affair is found out, the emotional drain which destroys a man's normal productivity, paying for bastard sons, paying alimony if your wife divorces you. I don't think they had alimony in the Old Testament, but in modern days we do. So yeah, you could be reduced to a loaf of bread real quick. You mess around with somebody else's wife. At the end of verse 26, Solomon says, an adulteress hunts for the precious life. How can sexual dissipation lead to loss of life? Well, there's sexual disease that you could get. You could get killed by a jealous husband whose wife you've stolen. You could get judicially executed in the Old Testament law. And, of course, you can lose eternal life if you don't repent. Pretty strong warnings against adultery. Verse 27, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Of course he can't. You take an adulteress in your bosom, she's going to burn you. She's not only going to burn your clothes, she's going to burn your bosom. She's going to burn everything about you. Verse 28, can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? Oh, yes, his feet will be scorched. There's no way he can do that without his feet being scorched. And that woman is going to scorch more than just her feet. So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Verse 29, whoever touches her will not go unpunished. One last comment before we leave verses 23 to 29 and Solomon's exhortations against adultery. Here's an apt metaphor. Can a man take fire in his bosom? If you think about it, that is a perfect metaphor. Fire in the bosom. Think about that adulterous woman in your arms around her, and she's burning you up. She's burning your chest up. We move now to Proverbs 6, verses 30 through 35, and we will see that Solomon is still not finished with his exhortations against adultery. I would think that what he said already is plenty to warn even the most randy man against chasing a woman who does not belong to him. But nope, Solomon's not finished. And so he continues in verse 30. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry, but when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give many gifts. Now, this section of six verses is a little bit confusing. The idea behind it is stealing is bad, but it's not as bad as adultery. So in verse 30, when Solomon says men do not despise a thief if he steals, but they do despise an adulterer who goes into an adulteress, they despise him. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he's hungry. Well, a man that's starving to death, he steals because he has to stay alive. You don't have to have sex with an adulteress in order to stay alive. So this is one more reason. It's not necessary to commit adultery. Now, of course, when a thief is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. That's bad, but in verses 32 through 35, we'll find out that the one who goes into an adulteress has a worse payment than that. He'll forfeit his life because the jealous husband of the adulteress is going to shoot him dead or kill him. They didn't have guns back then, but a hungry thief has to pay restitution. But by golly, with adultery, there's no way you can pay the jealous husband restitution. He will not accept any ransom in verse 35. He will not be satisfied, though you give him many gifts. A thief can make restitution, but an adulterer cannot. And so he's going to get destroyed. He's going to have wounds and disgrace and reproach. Probably he's going to get killed. Now, this is a little rabbit trail here, but you hear so many times people talk about sins, and they say, there's no difference in sins. A little sin is just the same thing as a big sin. There's no difference. Adultery or a little white lie, no difference. Murder, a little white lie, that is nonsense. It's true in one narrow sense, in that one little sin will get you to go to hell, but unfortunately, even the best people in this world don't commit just one little sin. They commit all kinds of sin. They commit all kinds of sins, and even if they didn't, they are born in sin with a sin nature, and they will go to hell without Jesus' blood covering them. So in that sense, it's true, but it's misleading to say that, because in this life, when you're talking about relationships with people in this life, it does matter. I would much rather have somebody steal my cell phone than murder me. There is a difference in sins. And this verse says right here, adultery is worse than thievery. So just to rehash here, a starving man can be said to have no choice but to steal, but an adulterer doesn't have to have sex to live. A starving man needs to have bread to live, but an adulterer does not need to have sex in order to live. Besides, he should be getting sex from his wife at home. He's not without, most probably. Now, I have a little question here that my commentators didn't seem to address. When the thief is found in verse 31, he must repay sevenfold. I wonder why, if he's so hungry, how he can afford to repay the person he stole from. How must he give up all the substance of his house, as verse 31 says, if he doesn't have any substance? If he's so poor, he's got to steal to eat. Now, John Gill tries to explain that by saying the restitution is only to be required should it be discovered that the man had no need to steal. But that's not what the verse says. It says if a thief steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry, he's found, he must repay sevenfold. I think Gill is splitting some hairs here. I don't think that makes a lot of sense to me. Just my speculation, it could be he's got to repay sevenfold when he gets the money. In other words, later on, might need to get it from his relatives. I mean, he could have been hungry and he needs something right now. He steals. Well, now he's got some food. People give him some food, and now he's got some time to go gather up the restitution from his friends and relatives. Maybe that's how that little problem can be resolved. There's another problem here. Verse 31 says the thief must repay sevenfold. Now, the scriptures don't say sevenfold. In Exodus 22, verse 1, we read in the law, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. That's not sevenfold. That's 5-fold for oxen and 4-fold for sheep. Exodus 22, 4 says, if what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. So if the thief fences his ox or sheep and sells it, fences it, he's got to repay 5 oxen and 4 sheep. But if he steals any animal and the animal is still alive and in his possession, he hasn't fenced it yet, he's got to pay back twice, 2 oxen for every ox that he stole. Now, we need to explain that law a little bit. First of all, let's take care of Exodus 22:4 that says that the thief who has the stolen goods in his possession shall pay double. Double what? Double the five oxen and the four sheep that are mentioned in Exodus 22:1. The restitution for fenced animals? No, that's not what it means. It just means two oxen and two sheep. Now, why is there less restitution paid for animals that are still found alive in the thief's possession? Well, the steeper restitution that is required when the stolen animal is fenced, stolen, gives an incentive to the thief not to fence his stolen goods. He might steal the oxen and think, well, you know, I could sell this oxen and make some money, but maybe I better just keep it and eat it. Because if I sell it, the penalty's much worse. Now, of course, by keeping the stolen property in the thief's belongings, it's easier to track down the thief and easier for the injured party to get his ox back. This is all my speculation, but I think it makes perfectly good sense. And one other interesting thing about this law, why, in the case of a fenced stolen animal, are there distinctions between stolen oxen and stolen sheep? Well, I think it's because oxen are worth a lot more for the sheep, and so it would be more tempting for the thief to fence that oxen. He would get more money for a stolen oxen, and so the law is stricter on that. It says, hey, you better think about that, buddy. You get caught doing this, and you're going to have to give five oxen back to the injured party, and oxen are very expensive. All right, we're still not finished with problems in this little verse. When the thief is found, he must repay sevenfold, says Solomon. Well, those two verses in the law don't say anything about sevenfold. If the stolen animal is fenced, if it's an oxen, five oxen are to be paid back to the injured party and four sheep to be paid back to the injured party. That's fivefold, fourfold. That's not sevenfold. In Exodus 22:4, if the stolen animal is found alive in the thief's possession and has not been fenced, well, then it's twofold. You pay the injured party back twofold, no sevenfold. So how do we reconcile sevenfold with these two verses of the Mosaic Law? I'm going to give you five possibilities. Here's one mentioned by Benson. The wrong person requires more than the law required. Well, why would the wrong person do that? Require more than the law required? I don't think that's reasonable. Option number two, the thief voluntarily gives back more than was required to avoid public shame. So let's say fivefold restitution was required in the case of a fenced stolen ox, and the thief says, well, I'll give you seven oxen back because I don't want anybody to know that I stole your oxen. Joseph Benson, the Methodist commentator, favors that option. Benson mentions another option, that Solomon is referring to laws in other nations. Well, why would Solomon, the king of Israel, refer to laws in other nations? That makes no sense to me. That's option number three. Option number four, Benson says the penalty was probably increased since the time of Moses, the law of Moses. By the time you get, for example, to the law of Solomon, when Solomon is writing, that thievery had gotten worse, and so Solomon had increased the law to sevenfold. Well, that's possible. Here's option number five, and this is my favorite option. The Hebrew number seven is an idiom that means completely. It's a symbol. For example, Matthew 18:21-22, then Peter came and said to Jesus, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? Completely, in other words. Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to seven times, but to 70 times seven. Seven times 10, which is another number that means a lot, completeness. Seven times 10 is 70, and then you multiply by another seven, and you get 490. Is Jesus saying that we're supposed to forgive, that Peter is supposed to forgive his brother 490 times? No. The word is symbolic of you completely forgive him, Peter. However many times it takes, you completely forgive him. That's the whole point. And so I think what Solomon is saying here in verse 31, when the thief is found, he must completely make restitution to the injured party. Now down in verse 34, Solomon says jealousy enrages a man. He's not talking about men in general. He's talking about the cuckolded husband. The husband who has had his wife stolen from him by the man who went into her. That tends to make husbands angry. It tends to make them jealous. They get enraged. And he will not spare in the day of vengeance. That means he's coming after you in revenge, and he's going to kill you because he doesn't spare you. And then in verse 35, you say, hey, I'm so sorry I stole your wife. Let me pay you some money. Nope, not good enough. Nor will he be satisfied though you give him many gifts. I'll give you my land. I'll give you my car. I'll give you everything I got. Nope. Bam, I'm going to kill you. How many jillions of times have adulteresses and adulterers been murdered in the act? In flagrante delicto. Whoops, there's my wife getting it on with some man that I don't know or my best friend. Bang! Shoot them dead right in the middle of what they're doing. Now, here's some other scriptures that talk about jealousy in general, not just jealousy of a wounded husband. Proverbs 27:4, wrath is fierce and anger is a flood, but who can stand before jealousy? James 3:14, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. That's just jealousy for power, not for another woman. James 3:16, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. Jealousy is a bad thing, folks. That's something that needs to be mortified. That's an aspect of one's flesh that needs to be killed by the Holy Spirit, as in Romans 8. Now, before we leave this chapter of Proverbs 6, I want to back up and go to verse 32. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. How can a man who goes into an adulteress destroy himself? Well, I just mentioned option number one, by jealous husband. Now, speaking of jealous husbands, this is how jealous husbands in the Roman Empire took care of men who stole their wives. This is not a legal thing. This is a private thing, a cultural thing that Romans would do. The injured husband would place a radish in the anus of the adulterer who stole his wife. After shaming him, the radish usually caused his death. That little tidbit of ancient history comes from Adam Clark. I think it's hilarious. Stick a radish up the man's anus. Of course, a man who goes into an adulteress could be executed legally by the civil magistrate. After all, the law of Moses said that an adulterer or a man who goes into an adulteress is to die. He's to be strangled or stoned. Leviticus 20:10, if there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Deuteronomy 22:22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. The man who lay with the woman and the woman, thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. That's probably why they didn't have a lot of adultery back then in Israel, because if you did it and got caught, you would forfeit your head or forfeit your life. Ladies and gentlemen, with those gloomy and severe admonitions, we are now finished with Proverbs 6, and we're prepared now to go to Proverbs 7 in our next audio. I will entitle Proverbs 7, Warnings Against the Adulteress. Solomon is not going to let it go. We're going to get a whole chapter next time on why you ought to stay away from adulteresses. Like, we haven't already hit that pretty hard, but Solomon's got a bee in his bonnet. So we'll see you next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.